Thank you. We've just heard Midori as the soloist with the Philharmonia Orchestra and their music director Esa-Pekka Salonen in the first UK performance of Do Re Mi, otherwise the Violin Concerto No. 2 by the 69-year-old Hungarian composer Peter Erdős. You heard it live from the Royal Albert Hall on BBC Radio 3, a home of the Proms. And a spotlight picking out Peter Erdős standing in his seat just to my right here, applauding soloist and orchestra and indeed conductor. Everybody I spoke to in the orchestra said that they found that piece enormous fun to play, teeming, as I'm sure you noticed, with quotations. You probably spotted more than I did, but you can't have missed the stabbing violins from the shower scene in Psycho, and maybe you spotted a treating of the woodbird from Wagner's Siegfried. I'm sure you also spotted that the bleeping watch isn't in Peter Erdős's score, marking the passage of 8 o'clock. I should perhaps just say the wonderfully duetting principal viola was Andrei Vitovich. Midori returning to the stage. She's of course collected many, many bouquets for her performances, but she's also collected a number of awards for her role as educator and community activist, very much engaged in getting young people involved in music. And last year, she received the Crystal Award from the World Economic Forum in Davos. Her full name, Midori Goto, and the instrument she plays is a guarneri made in 1734, which was once owned by Bronislaw Huberman. Soloist, orchestra, conductor, all on their feet, and another call for Peter Erdős, standing, holding his hands in triumph above his head, but rather gallantly passing the applause back to the platform. He and the conductor had a little chat at the end of the rehearsal, and Esa-Pekka Salonen had turned to the Philharmonia and told them, "We have here a very happy composer." Well, it was the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra which first introduced an audience to the Mighty Symphony, which is the one work we're going to hear in the second half of this concert as we move into the misty, melancholy world of Anton Bruckner's great tribute to Richard Wagner, his Seventh Symphony, with its orchestration permeated by the sound of four Wagner tubas. Our interval this evening was recorded earlier on just across the road in the Royal College of Music. It's introduced by Petro Trelawney.
Welcome to Proms Plus, where joining me to discuss tonight's programme are Mark van der Wiel, principal clarinetist in the Philharmonia Orchestra and the writer, critic and presenter of Radio 3's Discovering Music, Stephen Johnson. Welcome to you both. Stephen, the premiere of the Seventh Symphony was one of the greatest successes in Bruckner's life, but in the years before, he'd had a pretty torrid time.
It's a rather depressing story in a lot of ways. Bruckner went to Vienna on advice in his early 40s because he was starting to make a name for himself in his native Linz in Upper Austria. And he was told to go to the great city of Schubert and Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart. There he would make a great name for himself. And he arrived in Vienna and was promptly ignored by everybody. He did have some success as an organist. In fact, he even came over to the Albert Hall to give a recital at one stage. He was a truly extraordinary improviser, apparently. But his music was regarded with, well, something close to contempt. The first performance of the Third Symphony was a disaster. It ended up with most of the audience walking out. And then when Bruckner turned around to acknowledge the applause of the few who were left, the orchestra got up and walked off the platform and left him on his own. This is the interesting thing, because Bruckner is often said to have lacked confidence as a man, which in some respects he does seem to be remarkably keen to placate people, ready to take advice. But the fact that he went on composing after that and went on composing symphonies suggests that at a very deep level he must have had a pretty strong certainty of what it was that he had to do.
It didn't help that he got on the wrong side of Vienna's leading critic.
Oh, Eduard Hanslick, yes. But I think we tend to forget how conservative Vienna was in those days. I remember talking to a German musician some years ago who said ruefully, "Well, they persecuted, they mocked Mahler and Bruckner, they ignored Schoenberg and the late Beethoven, and they don't even know where Mozart's buried." which is interesting. They did seem at the time to be much more interested in Johann Strauss than anything particularly sensitive. And there was a very strong feeling against Wagner in Vienna at the time, apart from a small band of determined progressives. And Bruckner had made the probably tactical mistake of dedicating his Third Symphony to Wagner, and that damned him probably before a note was heard.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about Wagner's influence on the Seventh Symphony, which is substantial. Mark, this is one of the earliest pieces of classical music, the Seventh Symphony, that you came to know.
Yes, that's true. We had a small collection of LPs at home, and one of my father's favourite LPs was the Bruckner Seventh Symphony, and we played it again and again and again, so I've known it right from a young age and have loved it all my life, really. Robin O'Neill, the bassoonist, and I will be sitting together playing this piece tonight. We played the same piece in the same hall with the European Youth Orchestra many years ago. With this piece, there aren't particular technical difficulties. The difficulty, for me, is performing a piece well and accurately, which moves me so much. You have to actually consciously step back from enjoying it oneself. There's a bit just before the end of the first movement, which is so moving with cellos and winds in canon, that I have to consciously concentrate on breath speed, breathing, fingering, in order that I don't drift away into a dream with the music rather than playing it.
I think I know the passage you mean. Is it where the timpani come in for the first time?
Yes.
That is
yes.
A magical moment.
Yes.
And it's one of those Bruckner things that's so important. One of the things that Bruckner does, which some people adore and other people find intensely frustrating, is that he'll set up expectations, then he'll keep you waiting for the moment when they're finally fulfilled. But if you have the confidence that he's going to do that, and you just enjoy it and relax and kind of breathe when he suddenly seems to be building up a climax and then stops, when you do get to that moment, the one you're describing, where the timpani enter for the first time and this motif climbs through the orchestra with the echoes on the clarinets and the oboes, it is incredibly moving, isn't it?
Yes,
I'm feeling moved even just thinking about it.
Let's talk through the shape of the symphony. The story goes that the opening melody came to Bruckner in a dream.
Yes. I mean, this is a very moving story, given that at this stage in his career, there was some signs of beginnings of interest in his music amongst people who really knew what they were doing, like the conductor Hans Richter, for instance. But still, Bruckner was not a name as a composer at all, and at least not in Vienna. And a school friend, or I beg your pardon, a friend from his youth, a conductor called Ignaz Dorn, who had died much earlier, came to Bruckner in a dream, apparently, and played the opening theme of the symphony to him on a viola and said, "This will bring you success," so the story goes. If it's true, it's extraordinary, because it was the turning point in Bruckner's career. But interestingly for Bruckner, the first performance didn't happen in Vienna, where everyone was still largely set against him, but in Leipzig, which was a much, much more adventurous, intellectually curious place musically, partly because of the legacy of Liszt, who'd worked there for a long time. And it was an amazing success. And I think one critic said, "I have to admit, I don't think I've ever seen a composer call to the platform 5 or 6 times after each movement of a symphony." So you can imagine the effect of this on Bruckner. And yet it's extraordinary because the symphony, so much of the symphony has a serenity, which I wouldn't say is new in Bruckner, but it is something that you feel is almost, you'd expect him to write this after the success, not before it. It's extraordinary.
Let's hear that first movement opening and the theme that came in the dream.
Thank you.
You call that theme a gift of nature in your programme note tonight.
Yes, I think the word visionary is used far too much these days, but I think that's one case where I would say it was very apt, absolutely to the point. It really does seem to have come from somewhere other than the composer's own calculating mind. In fact, one friend of Bruckner's remarked that Bruckner had a fascinatingly sophisticated attitude to composing. I mean, he's often described as a rather naive composer who sleepwalked through composition. This is absolute nonsense. He calculated the structures of his movements very carefully, almost like a medieval architect designing a cathedral. But the friend who had observed the composition of this symphony said that this was quite different. This just came straight out onto the paper. And you can feel that it had that kind of quality of being given to him, almost. You can see why he thought it was God. He was a devout Roman Catholic, Bruckner, and felt that God had sustained him through many a trial and that this theme was one of the proofs of that.
He idolized Wagner to an extent that Wagner became a little embarrassed about his appreciation.
Yes, imagine Wagner being embarrassed by being praised. This is a very strange thing because lots of composers imitated Wagner. But in Bruckner's case, I think it was more of there being an affinity on a certain level. When Bruckner heard Wagner for the first time, I think he recognized it something that was already in himself. This sense of great space that you get in Bruckner's music, he's already moving in that direction before he discovers Wagner, largely because of his huge debt to Schubert and to some of Schubert's more spacious works. And that lovely sense you get with Schubert sometimes of him setting up a kind of hypnotic, mesmeric or meditative pace in a movement, often you find the same rhythm repeated over and over again with the tune on the top, which is very, very much a Bruckner kind of thing as well. But that combination of the sense of defying the movement of time that you sometimes get with Wagner, combined with this very sensuous kind of mysticism, which as Bruckner as a Catholic would be maybe more in tune with, this all, I think, spoke to him on a very deep level. How much he understood Wagner and what Wagner was about is a matter for intense debate, and there have been all sorts of speculations on this, but maybe it was a case of creative misunderstanding in some respects, but he clearly did find a kindred spirit in Wagner in some respects.
And yes. They met. How close did they become?
Oh, well, there's a lovely story about Bruckner taking the manuscripts of the Second and Third Symphonies to Wagner to see if Wagner would accept the dedication. And Wagner said, yes, yes, another symphony wanted to dedicate it to me. Yes, yes, you know, leave it there. Bruckner goes back at the appointed time and finds Wagner playing the opening theme of the Third Symphony. He says, this is very good. This is really very good. You know, come in and have a drink. And Bruckner gets so intoxicated in both senses with Wagner's company and with the beer that he's given that the next day he can't remember which symphony it was that Wagner agreed to accept the dedication. So he sends a nervous little telegram to Wagner saying, which one was it? Was it the one with the trumpet? Yes, 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 says Wagner. They met on several occasions. Bruckner was absolutely moved to piece to bits by Parsifal. The mysticism, again, you can imagine in speaking something very deep in Bruckner. And afterwards, he almost said, Master, he fell before Wagner's feet and said, Master, I pray to you. At which point, Wagner said, no, no, enough of this, Bruckner, good night. And swept out of the room. But Bruckner was always, interestingly enough, looking for father figures. And sometimes his own father had died when he was very young. And interestingly enough, one of the conductor he called my father in art, mein künstlicher Vater, was actually 15 years younger than him. So, you know, all the time he was looking for figures, male figures particularly, that he could attach himself to. And Wagner certainly fulfilled this function.
Do you see similarities in playing, Mark, this with Wagner's music?
As a player, I think in the emotional impact of the music, yes. In the writing for us, no. I would say it's very, very different. Wagner will use the woodwind far more soloistically, or far more often soloistically, whereas Bruckner will tend to use us sometimes as soloists, but often as a small choir. For example, you know, maybe a particular organ registration, or mixing us with other instruments. Mm. Now, the musical example that you already heard from the very opening of the symphony, you wouldn't hear that music and think clarinet. But we're in there, and the clarinet is mixed with the cellos and the violas to make a new tone, a new sound, which is exactly the sound that Bruckner wanted to convey that particular emotion. So although you don't hear us in the symphony all the time as soloists, we're part of the colour. And if you love the music as I do, that's immensely satisfying to play.
At the beginning of the second movement, Bruckner uses Wagner's own instrument, the Wagner tubas at the beginning. And I want to know what a Wagner tuba is, but let's hear them playing at the beginning of the second movement first.
If you're watching as well as listening, if you're at the concert tonight, at the end of the first movement, you'll notice Peter Smith, our tuba player, will walk from his normal position next to the trombones over to sit with the Wagner tubas for the second movement and then walk back again. Because the bass notes that you heard so richly just then are provided by the real bass tuba underneath the four Wagner tubas. And so Esa-Pekka Salonen has asked him to sit with them for that movement and then go back in his normal place for the other movements where he works with the trombones. And that richness of sound of those five players playing together is absolutely extraordinary. Now, I'm sure you'll all be in very good positions in the concert, but I can tell you, for that particular passage, the clarinets have the best seat in the house.
And deservedly so. What is a Wagner tuba?
They're the technical term is a sax horn, but they're somewhere like something between a horn and a tuba. If you've ever seen a Bavarian umpah band with those funny instruments with the big bent bells at the top, they're almost the same instrument, but played with a different mouthpiece, which I'm told is crucial. They're also, they've got a bit of a formidable reputation amongst players. One player I met from the CBSO, City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, described them as catastrophones because all the horn's ability to be unpredictable is magnified by about 10. But they do make a wonderful sound. One thing, of course, they have the same sort of range as the tenor and bass trombones. But one thing they can do much more easily than trombones is play legato, very smooth melodies, like horns, because they have valves, not the slide. So you don't get the slide between notes if you do it all in one breath. And they also have a wonderful effect. You may have got a sense of that in that passage, but a little later in the slow movement, when they come in for the first time on their own, after a wonderful solo of Mark, by the way.
Mark's crossing his fingers.
They come in very quietly. Some of the best moments with the Wagner tubas are very quiet. And there's an effect, like, you know, some kinds of organ pipe, where you hear the air go into the pipe a split second before the note takes, a sort of doo. They have that quality, and a friend of mine described it as being like biting into a ripe peach. It has just that, oh. And the harmonies they play there are quite gorgeous, too.
There is a sense of mourning in the second movement. Is it true that news came to Bruckner of Wagner's death as he was writing it?
I haven't been able to work out the chronology of this exactly, partly because we don't know where Bruckner was with the compositional sketching of this when the news reached him. But there is no doubt, by the end of the movement, where the Wagner tubas have a wonderful elegy with the bass tuba. It's the great moment in that movement. That the news of Wagner's death had reached him. And interestingly enough, the phrase that they play is very, very similar to, in fact, it's identical at certain points, with a phrase in a contemporary work, Bruckner's setting of the Te Deum. And it's associated with the words non confunda in aeternum, let me never be confounded. In other words, you know, I put my trust in you, O Lord. It's a it's a phrase that's also repeated in the context of the Requiem Mass. So there is an idea of commemoration of the dead here and the prayer for the soul, the repose of the soul.
We get that real sort of sense of Bruckner and that sort of rustic sound in the third movement, which is marked very fast, and there is a real drive to it, isn't
there? Yes, it is. In rehearsal, when you hear elements of the music on their own that perhaps you wouldn't normally hear on their own, when those accompaniment figures, which are repeated and repeated and repeated, it almost sounds like minimalist music. Yeah. The moment the melodies are there, it no longer does. Yeah. But it's interesting that that's maybe the way that Bruckner was building his music in blocks, in that way. You can listen to the scherzo as fast music, or you could listen to it in longer phrases, in which case it's perhaps not so fast, but it does have a real Viennese character and a rustic character, as you said, and a beautifully songful atmosphere in the trio section.
Let's, just as our last musical clip, hear the opening of the finale. It's surprisingly light, the finale, and short.
That's absolutely true. And Esa-Pekka particularly asked us to make parts of that movement sound athletic, was the word he used. He also was commenting on the little musical example that you just heard. The finale of the symphony, like the first movement, begins with a tremolo, although in the finale you only hear it on its own for a very, very short time. Moment before the melody comes in. But he said he'd always thought of the beginning of the finale as you would open a window and life was there. Mm. So he said it's not a mysterious opening, it's a springing to life.
Mm. We've run out of time, I'm afraid. Mark van der Wiel and Stephen Johnson, thank you both very much indeed.
And thank you to Petroc Trelawney, who was talking to the writer and broadcaster, Stephen Johnson, and the Philharmonia's first clarinetist, Mark van der Wiel, in that Proms Plus event. Welcome back to this prom from the Royal Albert Hall, live on BBC Radio 3, the home of the Proms. It's given by the Philharmonia Orchestra and their music director, Esa-Pekka Salonen. There's just one work in this part of their programme, Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. In talking and writing about Bruckner's symphonies, we often come up with images of massive architecture, cathedrals of sound, or of oceans or alpine landscapes. When I spoke to Esa-Pekka Salonen earlier, he came up with a very different, surprising image.
You know, Bruckner is a very paradoxical composer because we often use those words, architecture and vast landscapes and oceans and this and that. But there's also a child somewhere. And that I find absolutely fascinating. You know, when a toddler plays, he or she pulls out toys and puts them on the floor and then just very quickly gets started with it and then pulls out the next toy. And finally, as a parent, we all know, at the end of the day, the playroom is completely littered with all these kinds of things. And Bruckner somehow sometimes does the same, especially in his last movements, where he just pulls out things seemingly randomly out of his bottomless bag. And then our task, conductors and musicians like, is to somehow create the glue that unifies these toys. And this is not meant to be any kind of disrespect, rather than it's more a sort of intuitive feeling I get sometimes. It's alive. It's not some kind of a dead object like a cathedral or a sort of a postcard alpine landscape. They're not very adequate metaphors for this.
The conductor is Pekka Salonen. Well, the Seventh Symphony was the work which really made Bruckner's name as a composer and finally put an end to his years of neglect and even ridicule in Vienna. Bruckner liked to tell the story that the first broad theme you'll hear came to him in a dream. An old friend from his Linz days appeared to him, whistled the tune, and told him that with this theme you will make your fortune. Well, something like a year into his work on this symphony, Bruckner heard rumours that Wagner had gone to Venice for the sake of his health. I thought to myself that the master cannot live much longer. It was then that the music for the Adagio of the symphony came into my head. To make his tribute unmistakable, Bruckner gives the music a distinctive Wagnerian sonority, introducing a quartet of Wagner tubas, the instrument Wagner had invented to give a darker, burnished, more solemn coloration somewhere between a French horn and a euphonium. The movement which follows is one of Bruckner's great whirling scherzos with a sense of driving, cumulative power. It's dominated by a clarion trumpet call. In the finale, the Wagner tubas make another appearance, making a subtle allusion to the Valhalla motif from The Rheingold. Andrew Howeron has taken his place in the leader's seat. And now, Pekka Salonen joins the Philharmonic Orchestra to conduct Bruckner's Symphony No. 7.